Now it's going to be the space show.
You're tuned to Melbourne Radio Southern FM, where you hear nothing but great music. 88.3 Southern FM.
Welcome to the space show, which is presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and on this evening's The Space Show, Philae is now 1 week away from its landing on Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko, and this week's program is largely devoted to this historic event.
Rosetta, now it's time to rise. It's your time to shine and come back to life. So wake up, sleeping satellite. Wake up, Rosetta.
The Rosetta spacecraft has been in orbit around the comet 67P for some weeks now. We've been covering it and pretty much every show for the last couple of months. And now it's 1 week away from deploying the Philae lander, which is going to land on the comet. So tonight we're going to take a really detailed look at this mission, explain what it's all about. And the first thing we want to look at is why would we want to study comets at all?
Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko comes from the Kuiper Belt, which is filled with millions of similar frozen remnants of our solar system. Collisions or gravitationally induced orbit changes can eject some of these dusty, icy space rocks into becoming comets orbiting the Sun. Comets have long been part of our culture. The first known realistic image of a comet, for instance, was the Star of Bethlehem in Giotto's Adoration of the Magi, painted shortly after the appearance of Halley's comet in 1301. But comets may have played a more significant role in our history. Apart from containing water, glycine, one of just 22 amino acids in the human body, has also been found in a comet. And scientists believe comets may have brought water and organic compounds to Earth.
What it's all about is the carbon chemistry. How much did the comets bring to Earth? So was it just the right elements, the right building blocks, or was there more information in it when these comets already arrived?
Studying comets will shed light on the emergence of water and life on Earth, as well as informing us about the formation of our solar system. We know from previous space missions that each comet has a frozen nucleus, often only a few kilometres across, and that when a comet's orbit approaches the Sun, it develops an atmosphere or coma. The solar wind pushes this atmosphere into trailing tails of dust, ions and plasma that can stretch for thousands of kilometres. Water can be found in its tail, the icy nucleus, and as a vapour in the coma. Comet 67P may be a binary comet, possibly produced when two comets collided and melded together during the formation of the solar system. Taller than Japan's Mount Fuji, it rotates every 12 hours and 24 minutes. Comet 67P's distinctive two parts and complex shape presented unique challenges for the mission. But it is also providing a greater scientific understanding of who we are and where we come from.
This comet is called 67P, otherwise known as Churyumov-Gerasimenko. But how does a comet get such a queer name? Well, Claudia Mignone wrote a poem about the naming of comets, and it's here read by Space Association member Patricia Larkin.
The Naming of Comets by Claudia Mignone. The naming of comets is a complex procedure. It isn't a pastime, a sport or a game. You may think astronomers are peculiar creatures when I tell you the comets get more than one name. First of all, there's the comets from centuries past that are simply named after the year they rolled in, especially those that have made a big blast, such as the Great Comet of 1618. There's a number of comets that got named after humans, at times after scientists who figured stuff out. such as Edmund Halley, who studied the movements of comets and showed that, beyond any doubt, one comet he saw wasn't new to our skies. It had been here before, and it'd be back soon too. Round the sun and elliptical orbit it rides, back and forth every 76 years anew. Of names of this kind, I can give you a handful, such as Halley's Comet, or Encke's, or Biela. More frequently, though, they're given the label of those that discovered them, many astrophiles. That's why lots of comets bear a difficult moniker, such as Hale-Bopp, Swift-Tuttle, or Shoemaker-Levy, and of course Churyumov, Gerasimenko, so popular this year, even though to pronounce a bit heavy. Seems easy so far, because in fact I have spared you the most difficult part of this mad exercise. Besides year of discovery and name of the crew, for each comet a trademark you must memorise. At first it may seem like a meaningless series of letters and numbers and letters again, but listen to me, because in fact this mysterious arrangement of digits makes sense. I'll explain. Some comets like Halley's are bound to come back with a period no longer than 200 years. They're called then periodic, and onto their plaque a capital P letter suddenly appears. Ahead of the P there's a number to file, the discovery order, and later the year. So the comet of Halley, first in the pile, is called 1P1682, crystal clear. But not all the comets are so well behaved. Some have much longer periods or even unknown. Then their name gets a C or an X there instead, and a D in the case that it's forever gone. So depending on what kind of name you employ, comet may sound either charming or bleak, such as, for example, famed comet Lovejoy, also known as C2011W3. After this little story, you may well believe that some logic belies this quite twisted affair, and that after some practice, even you could achieve familiarity with it. But hey, don't you dare. It's a difficult matter, and to master it well, you need lots of practice to accustom your brain. Only then you may finally be able to tell which comet is which, but not without pain. When you see some astronomers in deep meditation, the reason I tell you is one to acclaim. Their minds are engaged in a rapt contemplation as they strive to remember this one comet's name, this ineffable, effable, effing ineffable, deep, unpronounceable, mythical name.
Thank you, Patricia. And Patricia's going to be back to read another poem about comets further down the show. Now, Rosetta, we've been covering it here on the Space Show for at least 15 years. A few years before launch, it was then supposed to be launched to a comet called Wirtanen, but the Ariane 5 exploded. Fortunately, not with Rosetta on board. And the mission was delayed. They had to retarget to a new comet, which serendipitously has turned out to be quite an amazing comet. And here is a summary from the European Space Agency on the 10-year journey since launch of the Rosetta spacecraft.
10 years ago, and Rosetta's journey began. The spacecraft set off for a distant rendezvous with Comet 67P, Churyumov-Gerasimenko. It used a gravitational kick from Mars and three from the Earth, circling the Sun almost four times and travelling over 6 billion kilometres to reach its destination. Along the way, Rosetta studied asteroid Steins and Lutetia. But the main priority has always been to examine a comet close up, see how it changes as it nears the Sun, and attempt the first ever landing. There wasn't enough sunlight to power all but the essentials in deep space, so Rosetta was placed in temporary hibernation in 2011. It spanned just once a minute while facing the Sun, so that the solar panels received as much sunlight as possible. Meanwhile, the internal alarm clock was set for January the 20th, 2014. When the day came, ESA's European Space Operations Centre, ESOC, in Germany, listened out for a weak signal from the spacecraft. And after a nail-biting wait, the signal arrived. Within 6 weeks of the wake-up call, all of Rosetta's 21 onboard instruments had been activated. In May, Rosetta put on the brakes and slowed down for the rendezvous. By the beginning of August, 9 thruster burns, including a small test burn in early May, ensured that the relative speed between the comet and the spacecraft had been reduced from 750 metres per second to 1 metre per second. As Rosetta got closer, its destination became clearer, and it was a surprise for everyone to discover that the comet was shaped like a duck. Rosetta arrived at its destination on August the 6th. Shortly afterwards, it became the first spacecraft to orbit a comet. The world's media gathered at ESA's Paris HQ in September to discover where Rosetta was planning to land. There were 4 possible sites, and one on the head of the duck-shaped comet, Site J, got the job. While the orbiter instruments are studying 67P, its cameras have produced some incredible images, some from just 10 kilometres away. But now it's time to get even closer and prepare for the first ever landing on a comet.
So what has been learnt so far? Well, we have this feature again from the European Space Agency.
The Rosetta mission is exploring 2 key scientific questions. Did water on Earth come from comets? And did comets help kick-start life on Earth? To do this, there are 11 instruments on the orbiter and 10 on the Philae lander. And since Rosetta came out of hibernation in January, we now know Comet 67P's mass, shape and rotation. Rosetta's cameras have shown gas and dust streaming away from the comet, locating areas of activity and imaging them for the first time. The orbiter has also detected water and gases in the comet's atmosphere or coma. And the COSIMA instrument is capturing dust grains on a target just 1 centimetre square. The grain detection system and impact sensors measure the mass and velocity of grains, allowing scientists to identify which part of the comet the grains come from.
This is the comet. It's roughly a 1 in 1,000 model, so the real thing is 1,000 times bigger. The landing site is roughly here, which we're aiming for to deliver the lander. It's the flattest part we could find.
This miniature version of Comet 67P, Churyumov-Gerasimenko, is at ESA's ESTEC facility, where Rosetta was tested before launch.
What we are studying at the comet with the instruments are basically what are the ingredients, which materials are present, and coming back to one of the objectives of the mission, how complex are the materials present at the comet.
The chosen landing site is close to areas of activity, so landing will be technically and operationally challenging. It could be a hard or soft landing, as the composition of the surface material is so far unknown. The comet's mass, of around 10 billion tonnes, and low density suggest it is porous. The lander's instruments will use light, electrical conductivity, magnetism, heat, and acoustics to examine the comet's properties on, above, and below the surface. Surprisingly, the ALICE, VIRTIS and MIRO instruments have shown that the comet's surface is relatively free from ice, even though it's far away enough from the sun to remain intact. Instead, it's more of a dark, thermally insulating, dusty crust. But then this mission has been full of surprises, and there will undoubtedly be more to come.
Reaching into your community, the Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
On this evening's The Space Show, we are looking forward 1 week to the landing of Philae on the comet. And yes, it's a very exciting time here. The landing is going to happen on Wednesday night, Thursday morning, our time. And we're all looking forward to it. Now, Marice E. Wrote this song for the wake-up event for the Rosetta.
Space for the human race. You're off to see the sun. Wake up, Rosetta.
so far from home.
Yes, so far from home it surely is. We said Patricia would come back with another poem. This time it's about the Rosetta mission again, and it's called Chasing Comets, and it was written by Laurie Smilin.
Chasing Comets by Laurie Smilin. Hello, thanks for checking in. We're still here, spinning, stuck, worried. Are you still out there? Are you well? Alone but safe? Okay. You were our heart's creation, our best imagination's hope, our boldest, dare to dream dreams, just dreams, except for you, for you. Then you, we vicarious, flew off, propelled in space-time on your so long, so solo journey, far, forever far from us. We're looking in wonder, earthbound, of your wandering. You soar into silence, then silent. Silence, cold, distance, distant. Were you misguided or lost? Silence. At first endured, but then, after years of it, silence. Seconds, minutes. More we wait. We cannot bear it. We wail. Our sun's light finally finds you. Warmth stirs something. Reminds you. It sparks some deep embedded memory. Chip hardwired inside you, probe. We fret. Have you forgotten? You call. You are still out there. We probe. You give no answers. You turn. You are still searching. You go. You know you're on our mission. You probe the outer limits, the depths, the limitlessness of our beginnings and end despair. We hope, wake and tin can probe. You can, out in the cosmos, fulfill our mortal yearnings, our dreams, stuff you are made of, perchance. Thank you for chasing comets, stuff we are made of. Thank you for checking in.
You're listening to the Space Show special on the Rosetta mission. Now, Larry O'Rourke is with Science Operations Group at ESAC in Spain, and he had this to say about what science operations do and the competing requirements of all the instruments and the mission planners and all those sorts of things.
Larry O'Rourke from the Science Ground segment down at ESAC, our Center for Science down in Spain, and Larry's going to tell us a bit. You saw a little bit of this from Holger in his science planning for Sirius, but of course, as I said before, it's not the only instrument we have, roughly speaking, and you can ask me why it's roughly. We have roughly 21 instruments between the orbiter and the lander. We have some instruments which are shared, and that's a monstrous task to actually plan all the slots. Who wants to observe what when? Some instruments want to be in different places, and Larry's the guy and his team down there. He can explain to you how that very complicated process takes
place. Absolutely. I'll do my best. So, indeed, the science operations is, you've heard a lot about spacecraft operations. We've had the fastest drivers in the world to finally place the spacecraft in orbit around the comets, and that's our role in Spain to ensure that we can maximise and extract the best science from these instruments. There are 11 instruments on board, but science operations is not new to ESA. Certainly for the science directorate, there are about 20 science operations centres located in Spain, a number of them currently in development and the majority in operations. In Spain itself, we have a science operations team of about 25 people, approximately. It's led by myself and by Michelle Coopers, is over there. And it consists of 25 people from 8 different countries around Europe. Certainly, it's a very wide knowledge team with a lot of experience in Rosetta for many years. But what do we do? What does science operations consist of? Well, if you imagine you have 11 instruments on board and on board the orbiter, all of them have their science goals or science objectives to achieve. All of them have certain fields of view. They want to achieve those goals, they all want to look in certain directions. Some want to look away far away from the comet. Some want to look at the centre of the comet, like the dust collectors on the some of the instruments which are collecting dust. They want to stay pointing at the comets. Some want to look at the limb. Some want to look at the coma. And it's certainly quite a significant work to try to ensure that you can achieve all objectives while keeping all the instrument teams happy, which is certainly what we've been doing for quite some time since the spacecraft awoke. We switched on the instruments in March, and since then we've been operating them. You have three main roles that we're doing then in Spain. We do centralised planning for all the Rosetta instruments, which is not only a case of gathering the observations from all the teams, trying to define when things happen and exactly what's pointing. Well, certainly the pointing is going to be key here, because only one instrument can drive the pointing. You want to look off the limb, then of course one instrument is saying, okay, we want to look at the limb, and everybody else looks where you're pointing the spacecraft. Besides the centralised planning, putting together all the observations, all minute by minute for the majority of the mission, we also want to ensure success of these observations. It isn't just a case of schedule and good luck. Of course, you want to ensure that that you have all the data, that the objectives have been achieved. If they have not been achieved, you want to reschedule and redo it all over again in the course of the weeks that follow. And finally, something which is extremely key for operations will be after lander delivery. You've seen the trajectories being flown by Flight Dynamics now by the mock leading up to the lander delivery, but after land delivery, then the team in Spain will be gathering. We've gathered for quite a number of years now the inputs from the teams as to what type of trajectories they want to fly. So from the science ground segment perspective, we will define the trajectories, how we will fly around the comets after land delivery from December onwards. That's it from...
Very good. Thank you very much, Larry. Again, I think you have an idea just how complicated this job is. And I know in the public domain, everything's driven by the images, but it's all these instruments working together, which is really going to drive the science of the mission.
Okay, just if I may, again, for the Irish audience, but also maybe for the other smaller member states of the European Space Agency, again, sorry for putting you on the spot.
That's okay, I'm right here.
Yeah, but could you just address very briefly the career path, the opportunities? I think it would be surprising for people to realise that it's not just the French, the Germans, the Spanish, although, of course, you live in Spain. But can you address the issue for small European states, how people like you get opportunities to work on big missions?
Well, I think ESA has a number of wide education outreach programs. In particular, for myself, I joined ESA nearly 18 years ago as a young graduate. I came with a microelectronics master's, and I moved to ESTEC to work as a young graduate for 1 year. While there, I moved more to spacecraft building, because there was an opportunity to actually build a small satellite for a mission at the time. And what I found is that when you enter the field, it's the enthusiasm you get, the motivation you get, it's not something which you want to leave. And I've been jumping in my career from spacecraft building in ESTEC, then of course here to ESOC for operations, finally to Spain for science operations. I think there's a lot of possibilities, a lot of open career possibilities in ESA. I think not many people, even in the small countries, are aware that there is a young graduate program, that there is a stagiairship available, that there are Spanish trainee capabilities. And I would certainly suggest that just look at the ESA website, where all this information is available, and welcome on board if you're able to get in.
Jean-Pierre Bibring is the lead lander scientist at IAS in Orsay, and he had this to say about the science expectations.
My turn to say good morning to all of you and to emphasize how moving it is to be here today, knowing that in 2 months ahead of us we'll be landing. And 2 months is exactly the time since we met with the comet August 6th, so it's really almost in. And as it's been emphasized by Fred at the beginning, it's amazing how successful this mission was already. In 2 months, we have already acquired a huge amount of data that really we never got before, and actually this press event could be only dedicated to what we have learned for this comet already. Of course, the emphasis now is what we will learn in 2 months, and I'm very happy to be here on behalf of the entire science teams. on the lander. As you know, probably the entire, so we have, as you will see, 10 instruments on board, and the entire science is sort of led by two people, my colleague being Hermann Bernhardt from MPS in Gothenburg now. So to give you an idea of the reason why we do all that, just two words on the framework, the big picture, as we say normally. I think to realize why we do all that, and a huge amount of people are really merging their skills and effort to make that happen, is really because, as I say here in a nutshell, we are really in the middle of a revolution of our thinking of how planets evolve. Why do we have such a huge diversity when you compare Earth to Mars to Venus to Jupiter, whatever? How that's feasible, although we know that essentially all the planets originate from a single solar nebula. What are the drivers of planetary evolution? It's even worse, if I can say so, when you compare the solar system to the other solar systems, stellar system that we see elsewhere. The diversity is really the qualification which now is really emphasized and exhibited by all the new discoveries we do here. And of course, that put the question that what drives the evolution? And I have just put out here three sentences just to tell you the sort of question that really are fundamentally revisited. What makes this diversity happen? Is the Earth unique in that sense? And if that's the case, to which scale? Is it within the solar system and within the galaxy? And of course, that's even more true for what is harbored by the Earth, which is life. Is life a generic process in the universe or in the solar system? And if so, why? And so it looks like these questions, you know, very often at many, for many missions, you are really asking them. But it's really true to say that now we have a lot of possibility to approach this question in a truly scientific approach with representation based on observation that lead to new predictions and new observations to valid or confirm or opposite, demonstrate that the representation went false. And Rosetta is just there, in between of that, because Rosetta is really in the core of that. It's not, of course, a mission that will answer all the questions, but will contribute in an absolutely unique way to answer part of these questions. In particular, because comets, we know now, have been accreted and have preserved the process through which they accreted very early on, at the end of the collapse of the nebula, which finally accreted, in which accreted all the planets. And we know now the processes that build the sequence of accretion really drove the pathway to diversity here. So we need to know what are the processes, what are the building blocks in terms of the material themselves, what's what the composition there. And as you will see, the composition is not only the elemental or molecular composition, but also the isotopic composition. What are the building blocks? What are the minerals? What were the gases? The water itself. We know that most of the water that we drink today comes from the comet. But in a sense, okay, it's funny to say so, it's not the most important thing to me. The most important that we know that comets, which although they are made of 80% of ice, should be the brightest place in the universe, and they are the darker. Comets are three times darker than the darker place on the moon. It's darker than this table. It's darker than the charcoal. And the question is why, although it's made of ice predominantly. And the answer is that it's essentially, it has trapped a lot of organic molecules, probably very refractory, very absorbing. We don't know the composition of which, because that's been discovered in 86 through the comet Halley flybys. We know that this material exists, but we don't know what the composition is precisely. And what happened at that time is that we thought that these molecules might be fundamental, because then coming with the water in the planetary oceans and probably in the Earth's oceans very early on, it might have contributed crucially to the emergence and then adaptation evolution of life. So we desperately need to know the composition, because in that composition we might have an idea what really is specific to what will lead to life. And of course the next question will be, is that specific to the way our solar system evolved, or is it a truly generic process in the universe and then life would be spread over everywhere? So the question on whether or not we are alone in the universe is really directly connected to what we are looking for here. So, Rosetta specific is that for the first time, as we already started again, we will closely characterize that material. We have not yet been so close with all the 20 instruments on board, 10 on the orbiter, 10 on the lander, that will, in a couple of ways, leave us the possibility to understand what the comet looks like in terms of the physical properties, what it's made of, the composition, internal structure, the activity themselves, what the energy source of that, what is the pattern, what the fate of this. And Holger just showed you an image which is originated from him, really, from the team, which is absolutely spectacular. When you see by the stretching of these images, as been done by these people a few weeks ago, or a few days ago even, that essentially the activity comes from topography things. Essentially, this comet might have been pretty rounded some while ago. But of course, as soon as you have the merging of the possibility for that gassing to go, it increased the pattern, and now we have almost two blocks that might divide actually in the future. The dream would have been that happened just the day after we landed, so we'll be the first to see the disruption of a comet, but probably it will be the next time. So Rosetta is very specific and of particular for the composition. We need to know the composition, as you will see. We will try to have composition measured both elemental, what are the elements there, isotopic for at least the light elements, and if I have time I will tell you why it's so important, and molecular, what are the molecules at each stage, ices and organics. So just two words to remind you that over the past 2 months, and actually since July 15, when we got the first images, we were very scared at the beginning. At the beginning, it was so scary to see this comet as it was. It was really unexpected, unpredicted. No one really in the model thought that we would face such a comet. And when we saw it rotating, the first view was, we won't be able to reach any place there. It was really scary. But then, as soon as we get closer with splendid images from OSIRIS, from the NAVCAM, and then many other measurements that were performed splendidly from the other people, suddenly it happened that we might really have reachable areas. And then I should really acknowledge the splendid work done by Flight Dynamics, both ASOC and at CNES in Toulouse, to demonstrate that although this body was an unexpectedly exciting but very scarcity, there should be reachable areas. So it was fundamental, because then we discovered that we could land and really contribute to what we wanted to contribute to understanding this comet. That's an area, the area in which we are, I put in the image that I'm sorry I love, because that's an image taken a few days ago from the lander itself. On the lander we have camera that will be operational, of course, in 2 months from now, and that's the famous autoportrait images when we see at the first glance at the solar panels and the comet on the back, and this is where we land if you see the arrow in red, and that the enlargement here, and you know here where we are now thanks to this NAVCAM camera, and that the enlargement from OSIRIS here. So really we have gone this spectacular zooming here, enabling to know where we might go here, and I will tell you now why we chose that and what the sort of science we can do here. And this is a list, I will not go through all of them of course, of all the measurements that we will try to process and to proceed and perform as we are there. And essentially it goes first from capability to monitor the global properties at global scale. What is the internal structure? Is that body stratified, homogeneous? Is that a nucleus within the nucleus? What is the material inside? Are there any processes that already try to make some sort of differentiation, although it will be spectacular because we don't expect that? We have for the first time the means to do so through an instrument that will both operate on the lander and on the orbiter during a complete revolution of the nucleus as seen from the orbiter. We'll also, for the first time, be able to characterize the structure from the magnetic field. We do not expect, although it might be, that the nucleus is magnetized. It would be a big discovery because it has also a lot of outcome. We don't know yet, but we have the way to measure that. And also, we'll measure the modification by the nucleus of the interplanetary magnetic field, which is driven by the sun itself, by the solar wind. Then, we'll go to regional scale. During the descent, we'll zoom progressively the area in which we land, and we have a lot of means to measure the regional scale. When we land, we'll make the 360 degrees panorama, of course. We'll also measure the gas pressure, which is really a big unknown there, the distribution of the gas also in 3D. So that will be done immediately after landing. And, of course, we'll have the capability when we land to measure I would say essentially most, if not all, the properties of the surface in which we will land. The mechanical properties, the physical properties, electrical properties, well, the dielectric constant, for example, that's also key to understand the evolution of this body. What are the thermal properties? And that's important in particular because either energy sources, you will have a gradient of temperature from the surface down to a few tenths of centimeters. We have the means to measure that because we have sensors that will be locked within the subsurface and we'll see the gradient of temperature, and that will be a direct indication of the thermal behavior and the energy behavior of this nucleus. But then, of course, we have a huge bunch of instruments which are devoted to analyze the composition down to a microscopic scale. And that's fundamental because, again, we never were able to measure the composition of the nucleus, of the cometary nucleus, really there prior to any outgassing or prior to any even transportation down to the ground. Because you know that we might have on the ground some cometary samples through micrometeorites, but they have been processed by a huge number of processes to be extracted first, then in the interplanetary medium, and then back to the Earth. For the first time, we'll be there and measure the composition prior to any modification by the Sun or ejection. How shall we do that? We have a drill made by the Italian Space Agency under their responsibility in Milano, and we'll get samples up to 20, 30 centimeters below the surface. Why that? Essentially because we want to ensure that the material we'll analyze have not been modified even very slightly by the last transport of the comet in the solar system within the past 6 years. So we'll really get pristine material as possible. And then these samples will be delivered to three instruments in sequentially, essentially, as we would do here. You take a sample and sequentially you transport it to different instruments, less and less, more and more destructively. And it's these instruments that will tell us the composition from the elemental to the molecular composition. And for the elemental composition, we have an add-on instrument that will work independently of these drill samples, which is an IPX built in Germany, that will essentially, as we do on Mars, for example, just be dropped on the surface, analyze the X-rays and the alpha pattern of the samples within a few millimeters square. And finally, we have some microscope, both in the visible and the infrared. So all this suite of instruments, coupled to not identical but similar instruments on the orbiter, will give you from the microscopic scale up to a micrometer in size down to the, I would say, macroscopic scale, as seen from the orbiter, a complete view of what these comets, how these comets behave, what the composition, either a modification of the composition from the material below the surface up to the time it's in the coma itself. That's not known for the moment. That will be fundamental to conduct in the future analysis of what we see outside and then try to translate that to what was in the nucleus itself. So this is essentially the instruments as they are labeled here. I'm not going through them. If you're interested, of course, I can emphasize that in the discussion afterwards. And that will essentially end my very little presentation to say that the reason why we chose J is because J essentially meets all the criteria we wanted to be able to fulfill the entire science sequence. In other words, in J we know that all the instruments, including CONTURT, including the microscope, including APX, all of them will be able to operate at least once to their full capability, to have one full rotation for CONTURT, to have at least one sample drilled and transported to all of the instruments that are needed for their instrument to be performed at least once during first, what we call the first sequence, which is what will be operational just after we land during the next 2 days, typically, so typically November 12 and 13. But then, although immediately, we will run to what we call the long-term sequence, the LTS, because the illumination should be sufficient after the proper orientation, optimization of the orientation of the lander, to conduct immediately what we call the long-term science with only the rechargeable battery on, and that should be able to cover the entire measurements to investigate the activity itself. So J is the site within the five that ensure the best that the entire goals we have would be met. So in principle, we are ready now to go to achieve a successful mission coupling the orbiter and the lander science. Thank you.
On the space show, we've been listening to Jean-Pierre Bibring, the lead lander scientist at IAS in Orsay, which is in France. And yes, we are now only a week away from that landing, and we are going to announce the name of the landing site. Yes, it was J. It's now been given a name, but we'll do that a bit later in the show.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
Stefan Ulamek is the head of the Philae Lander Consortium. He works at the German Space Agency, DLR, in Cologne, and he has these comments about landing techniques and other matters.
Now, as I said earlier on, one of the key things we're going to be doing now, and all of these data go into that, is landing site selection in November. And our next speaker is Stefan Ulamek from the DLR. He's down in the front row here. He's going to tell us a little bit about the technology, the hardware of the lander, and also show us a little bit about how they've been beginning to plan landing site selection based purely on data taken some weeks ago, rotation, illumination conditions, just as Holger talked about there. So, Stefan, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, and good afternoon, everybody. Okay, now, just as an introduction, before I say a little bit about the landing site selection, how do we really intend to land? How is this procedure going on? Now, what we intend to do is to push the lander in orbit backwards. So if you push a body back in orbit, what does it do? It falls down, and the same happens even on this very small low-gravity body on the comet. So we push the lander backwards, and it will descend to the surface. And if we do this smartly, what we are hopefully able to do, we will do it in a way that the orientation is so that the lander will hit the surface perpendicular to the surface and the legs downwards. At landing itself, we immediately fire two harpoons for anchoring. The gravity is low. There is a danger of rebouncing, even if the velocities involved are very low. And we also have a cold gas system, which will also press the lander to the surface, again, to avoid any kind of rebouncing.
So just before you go on there, Stefan, if you could, just to give people a sense of scope, what are the velocities involved?
Velocities involved, so the touchdown velocity is, of course, depending on the accurate density, what we do not know yet, is in the range of 1 meter per second. So 3.5 kilometers per hour, that's like if you're walking and bouncing against the wall, it's hurting, but it doesn't kill you, so this is not the problem for the lander as you have it for landing on the moon or on the Mars, that the impact energy is destroying your device. But our problem is the rebouncing, because even rebouncing with very low velocity, few centimeters per second, would make a big jump and possibly jeopardize the whole mission. So this landing in low gravity we had to test, and this is a test which has been performed in Max Planck Institute. In Gatlinburg-Lindau, where to compensate for gravity, we put a lander simulator with a representative landing gear, but the lander itself was more or less a mass dummy, and we were landing, under quotes, against the vertical wall. So that's quite nice, because you compensate for the gravity, you can measure the rebouncing, but of course there are some restrictions you have. You cannot test landing on soft material, for instance. So we did also other tests, only after Rosetta was already in orbit, because this facility, which is in DLR in Bremen, it's called LAMA, Lander Simulator, wasn't ready before. And this is kind of an industrial robot which, under quotes, calculates away gravity. So again, we had a model, a qualification model of the Philae lander attached to this robot, which with a complicated software device would lift the lander just to compensate for gravity. And these tests we could then perform also in some sandy material and under various conditions, also various slopes. So that's better in this respect as just the pendulum tests against the wall. This is a realistic velocity. It's about 1 meter per second. And you also see the device, this landing gear, has a central rod, and the central rod will be pressed into the body of the lander. And there is kind of an electric ratchet, like a generator, where the impact energy is then transformed into electric energy, not to keep it stored in the landing gear, and again, all of this to avoid rebouncing. This was our greatest fear when we designed the lander and when we still thought the surface might be very hard, like solid ice. Now, as you've seen the pictures and if you've probably read some information, there is an understanding that the surface may well be very, very soft, and rebouncing is not so much of a problem. Hopefully, we will not sink too much into ground. That's another aspect. Okay, next steps. Now we are in a quasi-orbit. Now we are at the comet. So, of course, our next task from the lander point of view is to select a good landing site, to find a good landing site. First of all, everybody of us was, of course, surprised when we saw the comet is not a potato, it's two potatoes, or a duck, or as you want. So we did some preliminary analysis on both the illumination of the comet and also potential landing sites we could reach with the flight dynamics, with the aspects I was showing before, and with a reasonably means not too long descent time from orbit. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stefan.
Thank you. Leo Enright with Irish Television. A couple of questions, if I may. Can I clarify where the rotational axis is? It goes through the neck of the duck, does it? It's
Well, if I go... So it's it's very bizarre rotation.
Through the neck.
Yeah, well, it's not wobbling. This was one of our fears in the early phases. So we are lucky in this respect. It seems to be a stable rotation around these axes I've shown you on the image with the grid and the pole. Yeah.
And my other question was to do with the landing sequence after release, but before you hit the surface. Can that cold gas system allow you to maneuver? Will you be able to pick a landing site in real time?
No, we cannot do that. There is no autonomy to steer around. Obviously, due to the long lead times, we cannot play with the joystick either. The cold gas was foreseen in the old days when our target comet still was Virtanen, the smaller comet. It was considered a possibility to use it to have a more rapid descent and to use it. Now, Churyumov is bigger, much bigger than Virtanen, so we do not need it anymore. We will touch down, as I said, with a touchdown velocity in the 1 meter per second range. So we now only plan to use this system immediately after touchdown to avoid rebouncing.
But let me ask a follow-up question just for the audience here. Typically, if once you deploy and all the simulations work out, you can't pinpoint land, but you have what's called a landing ellipse. And roughly how big is that on the scale of the comet?
The landing ellipse is fairly big. It's about 1 square kilometer. So we can choose an area about like this, you know? So we cannot really pinpoint down. And this is to a large extent due to the uncertainty of the orbiter position because of the gas drag in the comet. Again, a bit depending on the actual site we choose and on the mass and the density, but it's roughly in the order of a square kilometer or a bit less, 3 sigma. So it's a fairly big area we have to find.
Thank you. David Shukman again. On the question of the type of surface, I think you mentioned that there's an understanding now that it's softer than you thought, but I sort of missed that. Perhaps you can explain why you think it's softer and how soft and so forth.
We do not know the surface strength. There is some indication, if you look at these pictures, that it may be more dusty than really icy. When we designed the lander, we had an understanding that comets may be like solid ice, still porous, but solid sintered ice with dust grains. We've simulated this kind of material in various tests, and this would be very, very hard. If the surface is more like regolith covered, under these low gravity conditions, it may be very soft. Some people use the analogon of cigarette ash. You may use the analogon of new fallen snow. So very, very soft. But actually, we do not know it yet. And it's not clear whether the images and the data from orbit will really help us to understand the surface strength. So we will only find out when we land there and when we touch down.
That was Stefan Ulamek. He is the head of the FIDE Lander Consortium at DLR in Germany. Now, we did promise you to tell you the name of the landing site. Yes, it was previously called J. Well, it has now been named Agile Kaya. Now, this is after Agile Kaya Island, which is an island in the Nile River in the south of Egypt. A complex of ancient Egyptian buildings, including the famous Temple of Isis, was moved to Agile Kaya from the island of Philae when the latter was flooded during the building of the Aswan Dam. The name was proposed by over 150 participants in a naming competition run by the European Space Agency. More than 8,000 entries from 135 countries were received in 1 week. The winner was declared to be Alexandra Brust from France, who has been invited to the European Space Operations Centre in Darmstadt to follow the landing.